possibility of warm superconductor. On a cold day like this, it would be really nice to have warm superconductor. For me, it's cold. You know, I'm coming from Chennai, where the temperature is about 35 Celsius. Now, as John said, I have been collaborating with Phil Anderson for quite some time. And this is a photograph that I took a few months ago when I was visiting Princeton. And the day is something important. It also has some connection to superconductivity. LHC at Geneva, CERN, they said they will announce discovery of Higgs particle on the 4th of, am I supposed to do something? I'm sorry. So let me continue. So on 3rd July, the news had leaked to Princeton, and the community at Princeton was very happy that Anderson Higgs particle was discovered. And that's why I wanted to take that photograph on that day. And my collaboration with Phil Anderson also started very accidentally. Actually, I was at that time doing some problems in complex theory, neurobiology, and some quantum Hall effect. But then high-temperature superconductors were discovered by Bednarz and Muller. And then Anderson had some beautiful ideas, so I joined him. And it was a good time. So I have to acknowledge Phil Anderson for a long-time collaboration, which enabled me to enter superconductivity, and Vijay Shenoy, and Pathak and Jafari. This is what I plan to do in the next 50 minutes or so. I will talk about serious constraints on superconducting TC, as it is very evident from majority of superconductors that is available, and also from theory. And then how MOT insulators gave a new hope, and some concepts associated with it. And then what are the challenges? And then at the end, I will talk about some very recent paper, possibility of warm and wet superconductivity, not only warm, but wet also, in graphite, and something about five-fold weight new superconductor. This is what I plan to do. You all agree that superconductivity is the most remarkable macroscopic quantum phenomena. In some sense, a wave function is on the tabletop. You can touch it, and you can deform it, and it doesn't collapse. It's macroscopic wave function. It does wonderful things. It exhibits zero resistance state, and excludes flux, magnetic flux, Meissner effect, Josephson interference, and so on. Now, room temperature superconductivity is a holy grail of solid state physics. If such a superconductor is discovered, it will have profound technological implications, power transmission, superconducting magnets, tremendous applications in the field of medicine, Josephson switches, quantum computers, you know, qubits at room temperature, squid sensors, magnetic levitation, magnetic levitated trains, and so on. So sky is the limit. So it'd be wonderful to have this. Now, as you all know, superconductivity started in 1911 by Kay Middling once. When he cooled down mercury, he saw zero resistance, and then there is this Meissner effect, and this famous Josephson effect, in which you couple two superconductors weakly, okay, so there is an oxide junction barrier, so there is really a quantum mechanical tunneling of Cooper pair. And what is remarkable is, without connecting it to a battery, depending on the phase difference between the two order parameters, between the order parameters on both sides, there will be a DC current. It's a remarkable quantum phenomenon. This is called Josephson effect. Now, if you apply a voltage connected to a battery, there will be, in fact, an AC current, a counterintuitive thing, which is very visible when you do the following experiment. You take a superconducting ring and then have some weak links here. And then you can apply magnetic field, let it thread through this hole, and then if you measure currents and so on, you find beautiful interference, which essentially shows interference of macroscopic wave function, and the interference fringes being shifted up and down by magnetic field and voltage and so on. It's a beautiful phenomena. Now, in terms of application, I just want to show this. This is supposed to be magnetic levitation, a consequence of Meissner effect. It seems that the Japanese have achieved in maglev trains in the trail. They have a few tens of kilometers where they have reached 2,000 kilometers per hour. But of course, the train will burn because of air friction. So you have to shield it and so on. So without shielding, you can go up to 400 kilometers. So there is a lot of scope. Now, if only room temperature superconductors are discovered, according to some people, our mode of transport will be very different. I won't be flying from Chennai to Waterloo by air. I'll be traveling by maglev. I hope it happens in the near future. Now, we're talking about superconductivity in condensed matter. Now, if you look around in theoretical physics and in the world, there is a lot of quantum matter. So I have put it in this crowded transparency. If you start with the very basic thing, space and time, according to colleagues here, is a quantum spin system, a spin network or spin foam. According to other colleagues, space, time, and matter is actually a superstring matter. And there is a lot of darkness around. We don't know about 70% of our universe. It's a dark matter. We do not know what it is. It's definitely not part of standard model particles. So we will call it as dark quantum matter. We have no idea what it is. And if you look at quantum chromodynamics, the vacuum, the structure of which is responsible for confinement and asymptotic freedom and so on, is often described as spaghetti vacuum, a structured vacuum with a lot of stuff in it. And possibility of colored superconductors when you apply pressure to a collection of neutrons and make quarks liberate, you get colored superconductivity, nuclear matter. And in fact, in real experiments, you have the quark-gluon plasma, and then jet phenomena in when you have collision of protons and electrons and so on, and a neutron star as superfluid neutron. So variety of quantum matter is here. Now when we come to non-relativistic quantum matter, I mean, what you see in the lab, without any relativity, you have superconductivity, superfluidity, charge density phenomena, spin density phenomena, heavy fermions, Mott insulators, quantum Hall state, quantum spin liquid, quantum magnetism, and very recently, cold atoms. That is, you can collect millions of atoms in empty space and really decrease the kinetic energy and go to nanokelvin and do wonderful experiments. And you can do non-equilibrium quantum phenomena. And there are very beautiful phenomena called quantum fractionization, anionic, that's something that's neither fermion nor boson, anions, and emergent gauge fields, quantum order, quantum. But also, if you go into biological matter, it's fascinating that slowly quantum mechanics is sneaking in. We all thought that biology is controlled by hydrogen bond and quantum chemical bonds. Then it stops there. We have reaction rates, and we can understand several things using that. But there are very intriguing experimental signatures that perhaps even at room temperature, quantum coherence is very important, for example, in photosynthesis and in some enzymatic processes, proton tunneling. So the matter in biology also has a little bit of quantumness. Now, when you come to theoretical understanding of this system, very new ideas are coming. For example, entanglement, which is an old notion, thanks to quantum information colleagues, that it's coming in a big way in characterizing many body systems as well as many qubit systems. New theoretical methods in the recent past, for example, ADS-CFT correspondence, holography, or tensor network approach, and are being used for strongly coupled quantum field and many body systems. So these are all really very important methods because we are frustrated. There are very, very simple looking strong coupling problems that we come across, as we will see, in many body systems, which we don't know how to handle it. So similarly, in quantum matter, like a piece of some lab-made material, we are looking for Majorana fermions, which could be used as topological qubits or Fibonacci anions, and so on. So quantum matter is ubiquitous, and we try to understand properties of them. And one of the big aim is designing room temperature quantum matter. Is it possible, that is, can we avoid cooling the system to feel the quantum phenomena? Can we design room temperature quantum matter? So this is, in fact, the nature of the question in this colloquium. And of course, superconductors it has tremendous consequences. This is something that repeatedly happens in physics. You understand some quantum system or classical system deeply, it has implications elsewhere in very different corners in physics. I can give several examples, and superconductivity is a very nice example. BCS theory of superconductor had a very special and unifying role in physics. It provided key insights for unification of weak electromagnetic and strong interactions, the standard model of elementary particle physics. Notion of spontaneous symmetry breaking is very, very fundamental in standard model. And Nambu Jonalusin, you got an idea from superconductivity of how gap generation superconductor used to do with mass generation in high energy physics and chiral symmetry breaking. And I was alluding to Anderson Higgs phenomena, that some phenomena that happens in a standard superconductor, namely photons acquiring a mass, gave some clue to mass generation in elementary particle physics. That is, in a simple model, there are too many gauge bosons which are massless, and they are all Higgs, and they acquire finite mass due to Anderson Higgs mechanism. And recently, they have discovered this Higgs particle. And it's exciting that the fundamental clue came from BCS theory. And similarly, understanding spectroscopy of the nuclei, where there is pairing forces, and the pairing phenomena is happening in finite nuclei. And of course, superfluidity in neutron stars, which explains several pulsar phenomena, including glitches, vertex, lattice, and all kinds of beautiful things happening there in the superfluid neutron star. Of course, there, it's much higher than our room temperature, because there the system is very dense. So the characteristic temperatures are thousands of times larger. Now, we are looking for theory in new physics and possibility of warm superconductors. So perhaps there will be another, it will have another special role in physics. Already you can see very nice ideas like emergent gauge fields, quantum order, topological order, novel entanglement structures, and so on. Now, one of the problems which is not often discussed in textbooks or in other places is it possible to predict limiting values of physical properties of non-relativistic matter? For example, what is the highest density of a solid that you can ever make in the lab without applying pressure? It's a non-trivial question. Of course, you can make order of magnitude estimate. For example, using Bohr radius as a fundamental unit, you can't compress atoms through chemical binding to short inter-atom distance cannot go much less than Bohr radius. So there are such considerations. But can we go beyond and become very precise? Can we do ab initio calculations? So there are simple questions like, what is the highest density that we can reach in man-made material? What is the highest melting point? It's practically important. For example, the space shuttle that's going up, Challenger, they have to withstand very high temperature, so you need to make ceramics with very high melting point. You need to have some hard material, very large Young's modulus, for example. And in many recent practical situations in spintronics, you need ferromagnetism with dilute carrier density. So you need it to be a room temperature ferromagnet. And at the same time, you want it to be transparent. So is it possible to theoretically predict that such a thing is indeed possible? And there are lots of work which is still incomplete. Similarly, highest TC superconductivity, highest resistance, and highest viscosity. And then question is, can we synthesize some material where we can have qubits acting without getting decoherent at room temperature? What is interesting is the basic input are very simple things, electric charge, mass of electron, and the mass of proton, and atomic numbers of the atoms involved, velocity of light, and Planck's constant. Now, still we are not powerful enough to start from Schrodinger equation and do ab initio calculation, not yet. On the other hand, lots and lots of beautiful progress have taken place over years, over decades, using microscopic models at various stages. with phenomenological inputs. So this is really helping answer several questions to some extent. In fact, this is the attitude that I will take, like many of us do, in condensed matter problem. Now, in once superconductivity was discovered, it was very clear that it would be desirable to have room temperature superconductivity. So there were theoretical attempts, and there were experimental attempts. And I will say that experimental attempt has been more fruitful than theoretical attempts. For example, after years of efforts, a new breakthrough took place with the discovery of superconductivity in cuprate by Bednarz and Muller. It reached new height, 163 Kelvin. Similarly, very soft organic material, you know, which is not even a the carrier density is very low, and it manages to become a superconductor with a TC which is 13 Kelvin. Similarly, oxides, which are often very bad metals, manage to reach a TC of 40 Kelvin. Nickel borocarbide, 24 Kelvin, and carbon-based system, 40 Kelvin, and the new full iron arsenide system, 56 Kelvin, and there is a claim that it goes up to 70 Kelvin. So experimentally, lots of beautiful progress have taken place. And inspired by various theoretical considerations, there are theoretical suggestions of Little, Ginsberg, bipolar, and so on. I will come to them a little later. Now, you have to look at the agony of experimentalists, because theorists are very bold to say that you go through a bipolar on, or you pressurize hydrogen, you will get 400 Kelvin TC. According to Litton and Ginsberg, in the excitonic mechanism, you'll get room temperature superconductivity. And now, B.T. Mathias, he has a rule for superconductivity. So try to choose cubic structures, because that is less susceptible for lattice distortion. Avoid oxygen, avoid magnetism, avoid insulators, and don't talk to theorists. He's an outstanding experimentalist and discoverer of new families of superconductors, including niobium-3 germanium, the famous A15 family, member of A15 family, that held the highest TC till 1986. The TC was 23 degree Kelvin. Now, it turns out, in spite of Mathias's great experience and the knowledge he had and the new systems he discovered, in some sense, all of them are failing, actually. In the cuprate, which took us to 163 degree Kelvin, oxygen is very important. And in the same cuprate, magnetism is very fundamental, as we will see. And then it's a planar structure. Now, well, don't talk to theorists, I have a. So the question is to talk or not to talk. Okay, the dilemma. Now, I will give two examples in history, in particularly in superconductivity, where people have immensely benefited by talking to theorists. I do not, maybe some of you know this. When Kamerling Wills once discovered superconductivity, actually he was trying to prove a theory of Lord Kelvin. According to Lord Kelvin, who believed in that, at that time only Rutherford's model of atom was there, conduction electrons in metals should get attached back to parent ions as we lower the temperature. Because the view was electrons are bound to nuclei, so temperature liberates them and they move as free electrons and they should get back. So every metal is likely to become an insulator at sufficiently low temperature. This was Lord Kelvin's theory. And in fact, Kamerling once wanted to prove Lord Kelvin right. And he took mercury, because mercury is a metal at room temperature. So you could purify it. So you could have very clean crystalline mercury at low temperature. And he ended up discovering superconductivity in mercury. Next. Now, in similar fashion, in fact, I know the story rather well, Bednarz and Muller at IBM Zurich. In fact, Muller is very well known for his work in ferroelectricity, quantum ferroelectrics, and so on. Bednarz was his research associate. They were inspired by a theory based on so-called Yanteller effect. I will not go into the detail. That could lead to binding of electrons, rather strong binding of electron, and there was a theory. And inspired by this, they made this lanthanum copper oxide compound, or they got it from others, looking for superconductivity. And they ended up discovering cuprate superconductor, where there is no Yanteller effect, because the C-axis is very different from AB plane, so there is no Yanteller distortion, no lifting of degeneracy by spontaneously. But an entirely new mechanism, I call it as RBB mechanism, based on electron correlation. So the moral of the story, according to me, is listen to theories. They will put you in some good track where things might be more interesting than one wanted. I hope some experimentalists are there in the audience. They may have other stories to say. Because I told you only two good stories. There are many other stories. Now, can we get some clue about the possibility of high temperature superconductivity by looking at the periodic table? The answer is no. Because elemental metal, many of them become superconducting with very low TC. For example, if you take gallium, 1 degree Kelvin, zinc, 1 degree Kelvin, beryllium, 0.02, and zirconium, and so on. Maximum TC is held by niobium. And next is lead, and so on. Even iron becomes superconducting, the ferromagnetic iron, under very high pressure. First, it loses its magnetism, and then it becomes superconducting at 1 Kelvin, rather low. Similarly, many other materials become superconducting. Even oxygen becomes superconducting at extremely high pressure. So this is not helpful. So if you look at the history of experimental superconductivity, this is the history. After discovery of superconductivity in mercury, many, many new systems were discovered, mostly compounds. And then there was this quantum jump. Now, which took us beyond liquid nitrogen temperature, that is liquefaction of nitrogen. So it's kind of it makes common sense that the mechanism operating here is perhaps different from here, because it has really took us to a new level. And then after this, inspired by this discovery, new system, very low temperature superconductor, but still very fascinating, hydrated sodium cobalt oxide, boron doped diamond, iron chalcogenide, iron mutate, and so on, and fullerite superconductors. Okay, now, if I want to understand superconductivity, let's try to understand it in elemental metal. This is how Bardeen Cooper and Schrieffer and earlier people started. So you want to model. So it's modeled as an electron gas interacting with the lattice of ion. So there is important screening, and a stable harmonic solid is formed, and electrons are described as Fermi liquid. So electrons are dynamically described in terms of so-called Landau quasi-particles, electrons and holes, and then the lattice dynamics by harmonic form. So if you look at the important energy scale in a metal like mercury, the Fermi energy is very large, like 5 to 10 electron volts. Each electron volt is like 10,000 Kelvin. Debye energy is very large, about 500 Kelvin. So now when you move an electron, it deforms the lattice, so there is some energy scale associated with it, which is like the electron-lattice interaction, which is about 10,000 Kelvin. Now, using this large energy scale, how does the system manage to get superconductivity, which is always less than 10 Kelvin in all metal? So this is a very important question. Now, this is where BCS theory did a beautiful job. They used the notion of Fermi liquid as a reference state, and superconductivity was viewed as a minor instability on this vacuum. Just one minute about Fermi liquid. If you look at textbook, free Fermi gas has distribution function like this. In the ground state, it's all occupied at momentum Kf and then empty outside. Now, in a Fermi liquid theory, what happens is, because of interactions, some of the electrons from the filled state are thrown out. So they are virtual transitions. But you continue to have this discontinuity in momentum state. So such a matter will be called a Fermi liquid. Now this ZF is, in a field theory language, is called wave function renormalization constant, which says that quasi-particle close to the Fermi level behave like a heavy object. The electron mass is renormalized by Z, which is less than 1. So you have an M star. And it's remarkable in heavy fermions, some family of metals, the Z can be very, very low, so that M star is as large as 1,000. So electrons move very with great difficulty. But still, it is a Fermi liquid in the sense there is a finite discontinuity. So this, as long as there is a finite discontinuity, you can go close to the Fermi surface and divide things by ZF and treat the problem as it is a free Fermi gas. So that's the spirit of Landau's Fermi liquid theory. And then residual interactions between electrons and photon lead to superconductivity. What is the primary residual interaction? For example, if you inject a phonon, it could create an electron hole pair. So if you take this as a basic vertex, like you know, it happens in nuclear physics, two nucleons get attracted by exchange of mesons, two electrons close to the Fermi level can get attracted by exchange of phonon. Physically, what happens is You imagine a wave packet of electron built from states close to the Fermi surface. As it moves, it creates a lattice polarization. You can imagine exciting one phonon quanta virtually, and then the electron runs away. Another electron with large velocity, namely Fermi velocity, comes and feels this quanta and absorbs it. So there is a retarded interaction, because in real space, two electrons will repel. But in the presence of this retarded situation, they can attract. And that's what BCS did. And they explained this very important thing, that a very small fraction of electrons at the Fermi surface, they participate in Cooper pairing. And their the shell size is about h cross omega d, because that is where the matrix element becomes attractive. I'll not go into the detail. And what is interesting is the fraction of electrons that get modified is very tiny compared to the full electron density. That fraction is h cross omega d divided by Fermi energy, much less than 1% in many cases. So there is severe Pauli blocking, in the sense an electron here, like 2 electron volts below the Fermi level, doesn't get affected because of what is going on the Fermi surface. So most of the electrons remain useless as far as superconductivity is concerned. And that's very that's very clear if you look at the expression for superconducting transition temperature as discussed by, discovered by BCS. There is a Debye energy, and then there is an exponential dependence on density of states at the Fermi level and electron proton coupling constant. All this is derivable from a beautiful BCS model Hamiltonian, which is formally exactly solvable. It is very simple. You learn it in your advanced solid state physics when you learn second quantization. You have free Fermi gas. There is some chemical potential, so electrons are filled up to some Fermi energy or mu. And then it says that if an electron lies within a shell around the Fermi surface, in energy range h cross omega d, k and k prime and minus k prime, they can get transferred to another state, k and minus k. And the matrix element, energy you gain is g. So this is a very simple scattering in which a zero momentum Cooper pair gets scattered to another zero momentum state. And this is exactly solvable for this model Hamiltonian, whereas I should have put a prime, which means that this interaction is restricted to a thin shell around the Fermi surface. Now, it's a beautiful theory. Then people wanted to immediately use it to increase TC, because I have a very nice expression. So if I can indefinitely increase h cross omega d, or indefinitely increase electron density of states, or indefinitely increase electron proton coupling constant, I will make this unity, and then I will have very large TC comparable to Debye frequency, which can be 500 degree Kelvin. It was pointed out by Macmillan, Anderson, Cohen, that if you look into the formation of a solid, finally, you know, you have ions and electrons which are interacting. And the fact that you have mercury, which is a self-bound solid, is coming from electron-electron repulsion, electron-ion attraction, screening. So there are serious constraints which make all these three parameters interdependent. So if you increase one, other will change in the wrong way. So they found out, it's a very beautiful work actually, not precise theorem, but it's almost like a theorem, because you can't prove theorems in condensed matter. So these people showed that phonon-mediated superconductivity cannot exceed 30 degree Kelvin. So going back, it's all due to the fact that there is an underlying severe Pauli blocking, and h cross omega d cannot be increased indefinitely. So the natural question is, how do we escape Pauli blocking and increase pairing? Now, with hindsight, we can say, avoid K-space filling and Fermi liquid vacuum. Think about this metal like mercury as a vacuum. Avoid that Fermi liquid vacuum where electrons are filled in some sequence of single particle states. In other words, create a non-Fermi liquid metallic state where real space pairing or singlet formation is increased. Interestingly, Coulomb repulsion can help a strong and real space pairing. This is what I'm going to say based on this very important discovery that took place in 1986. It was Bednarz and Muller. Now look at the system they discovered, namely lanthanum copper oxide, which when alloyed or when doped becomes a superconductor. Look at the change that we have made since 1913 to 1986. It's like Wright brothers, their first aircraft, which was a very, very simple looking thing, and the modern jumbo jet. So you have mercury, which is an elemental metal. It exhibits superconductivity, 4 Kelvin, got Nobel Prize. Now lanthanum copper oxide, look at it. There is lanthanum, there is copper, there is oxygen, and then there is barium. And this is an octahedra. The red atom denotes oxygen atom, and copper is at the center. And this blue atom is supposed to be either lanthanum or barium. So in order to, so there is a message that in order to get superconductivity, you need some complex structure. There's a question mark also. In fact, this is a route that many people took. So they, what they did was they took this system and then made analogous system in which they, instead of having a pyramid, instead of having a, what is this? Instead of having the octahedron, they had planes and the TC increased. So there is a family of cuprate compound, and they had reached the maximum TC of 163 degrees Kelvin. Now, what is this system? This system is very special. Essentially, what happens is, if you look at the formula, lanthanum has even number of electrons, oxygen has even number of electrons, and copper has odd number of electrons. So if you take one formula unit, what you find is there is an odd electron. So essentially, this green octahedron contains one extra electron. And if you look at the distance between two octahedra, they are too large. So if you think in a very simple term, an electron that is in this unit cell cannot easily tunnel quantum mechanically to the other unit cell. So in some sense, these electrons want to stay in this in its home unit cell. So this is the system that they landed with. And in fact, if you do experiment with this, it was discovered by Rao and colleagues in Ganguly in India before the discovery of superconductivity, that it's a Mott insulator. I will explain what a Mott insulator is. So it's a very complex system where there is no obvious Fermi surface because it's an insulator. So in fact, the fact that it's a Mott insulator was emphasized by Phil Anderson at the beginning in the RBB theory. Now, the message was that Mott insulators, as opposed to Fermi liquids, are seats of high degrees of superconductivity. So now this is a route that we have to take. Now, super exchange, as opposed to exchange of phonon, is a pairing. I will explain this very quickly. Now, how do I understand this phenomena in which I have a diluted metal? That is, I have expanded the lattice parameter in lanthanum copper oxide. I have a carrier in each unit cell. They are not very close. So let us do this thought experiment. Let's imagine you have a cubic lattice of hydrogen atom with lattice parameter close to Bohr radius. The 1s electron wave function will strongly overlap, and they will start conducting, and it will become a metal. There will be screening, and you will have a half-filled band because each k state can accommodate 2 electrons. So the 1s band will be half-filled. Number of electrons is equal to the number of k states, but each k state can accommodate 2 electrons with up and down state. So it's in a simple way explained by a so-called Hubbard model, which is a tight bending model in which an electron from site I in some Wannier orbital with a symmetry of 1s hops to neighboring site with this hopping matrix element. So this is a hopping term in second quantization notation. And then it also says that if there is an electron here, I'll find it difficult to hop here because first I'll have to pluck myself away from my proton, and then I'll have to take advantage of some electron affinity. If you put it together, typically this U is positive. So it says that as these electrons are freely moving, whenever they sit on the same side, they feel a repulsion. Now, in this situation, when the Bohr radius is comparable to, or when lattice parameter is comparable to Bohr radius, the bandwidth, which is coordination number times T, is less than U, so it is a metal. Now, it was suggested by Mott to explain some phenomenology. I will not go into the detail, but he said that let's take this metallic hydrogen and expand the lattice parameter, expand by, you know, a thought experiment. So, and it's when the lattice parameter becomes large compared to Bohr radius, something remarkable happens. If you think about it, you will find that when this happens, an electron will rather sit at home in a hydrogen atom than quantum mechanically tunnel and form block state. Because finally everything is a question of minimizing the energy. I was able to minimize the energy because the tunneling matrix element was large, so I delocalize and gain a delocalization energy, or I gain kinetic energy. Here, if I do that, I will gain very little kinetic energy, which is related to my hopping matrix element, which is very small. Because the probability of tunneling from one atom to another atom becomes exponentially suppressed as I make the lattice parameter larger and larger. So electrons will rather sit at home. So this is a Mott insulator. Very easily described in words, but in theory, it's very hard. So we are going to this situation. The bandwidth is small compared to the electron-electron repulsion. And now this is a remarkable insulator, very different from an insulator like diamond. If you take diamond and look at the band structure, what you have is you have block states and you have gap. Certain bands are completely filled and you have a gap of 5 electron volts. So it's an insulator. Now, if you want to do anything to the electrons there, suppose you want to flip the spin, we'll have to give 5 electron volt energy to a diamond diamond solid in order to create an excited state where there is a free spin and a free charge. Whereas here I have a beautiful insulator where if I want to do something to the spin, I don't need to do anything. I can just apply some field and then flip the spin and move it around. Whereas I can't touch the charge because it is very hard to, because of this gap. Electrons are stuck to their hydrogen atom. So it is an insulator as far as charge degrees of freedom are concerned, but as far as spins degrees of freedom are concerned, it's very free. So it's a very peculiar insulator, unlike diamond, which is a band insulator. So this is called a Mott insulator, where spin degrees of freedom are relatively free, whereas charge degrees of freedom are frozen. So this is a remarkable situation. This is at the heart of most of the magnetism that you see in nature. For example, if you look at rust, which is called magnetite or hematite, there is antiferromagnetism and sometimes ferromagnetism. The magnetism comes because of the physics of this Mott insulator. So Mott insulator is ubiquitous in nature. There are mountains of Mott insulator. So now I'm going to show that going from a Fermi liquid, namely a hydrogen metal, to this is to our advantage as far as superconductivity is concerned. This was the message of RBB theory. It goes like this. So I have managed to create an insulator where electrons are free, but then quantum mechanics won't stay idle. What, for example, suppose I take 2 neighboring sites. It is true that electrons would like to sit at home, but occasionally would like to undergo a virtual transition and come back. It's like children at home. You confine them. They will go to neighbor's house and get some sweets and come back. So in the same way, an electron can hop to the neighbor. Of course, it's a high energy state. Then it will come back, for example, if they're changing the spin. So if you do perturbation theory, what you find is you gain an energy by second order perturbation theory. And what is remarkable is this gain in energy is dependent on the spin configuration. Suppose I had spins which are in triplet state, Pauli blocking prevents you from doing this transition. So a Mott insulator is not idle. It actually communicates. It makes communication between spins in an antiferromagnetic fashion. It says that 2 neighboring spins can be very happy and you can gain energy by forming a singlet, which I have denoted later. So this is all summarized in the famous Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which says that if you give me a Mott antiferromagnet like this, the low energy physics is governed by an effective Hamiltonian, which says 2 neighboring spins have an antiferromagnetic coupling. So Pauli principle, together with Coulomb repulsion, join hands in distinguishing singlet and triplet. So that's the beginning of magnetism. In fact, magnetism is arising because of fundamental fermionic nature or Pauli principle and Coulomb interaction in this particular system. Now we will see that this state is very different from what we have in mercury. For example, if we take lanthanum copper oxide, essentially, the physics that I talked about is going on. That is, there is a spin in a copper oxygen unit cell, which has a very small matrix element for hopping. So it stays put, but occasionally it has antiferromagnetic coupling. So as a consequence, what you find is it forms singlet. And then since I have doped the system, which means I have removed some electron, I have some hole. So now if you stare at it for a while, which is what Phil Anderson did, there is superconductivity in the sense I formed singlets in momentum space. I paired electrons in momentum space here. In cuprate, nature has given me singlets in real space. And of course, quantum mechanics tells that they won't stay here. They will start moving around. They will start resonating. because this is not an eigenstate. So large positive U prevents Fermi-C formation and creates local singlet. Nearly all electrons begin to participate in superconducting or a finite fraction, not a small fraction like H cross omega D divided by Fermi energy. So this is, okay. Now, just a few words about this Mott insulator. If you look at momentum distribution in a Mott insulator, it has no discontinuity like this. ZF has become zero. Interestingly, even in a metallic state, when you move away from Mott insulator, that's what happens. And we understand it in the case of 1 plus 1 dimension. We don't understand it in 2 plus dimension. There are lots of good approximate theories. So this is a great challenge. And this is where many of good friends try to use ADS-CFT correspondence in trying to understand some behavior of non-Fermi liquid state in cuprate. Okay. So this is history. I'm not going into it. So the main idea is that Mott insulators are seats of high temperature superconductivity. Super exchange is a fraction of electrons participating in superconductivity is not this, but a proportion of electrons that I have removed in this lanthanum copper oxide by doping. So you make use of existing singlets or singlet interaction and get superconductivity. Now this is what we did in our early work, that you have superconductivity, and I will not go into detail. Now, what is the lesson that I have learned from RVB theory is that in this theory of superconductivity, which explains cuprates very well, there are three important parameters, T, U, and X. And T and U, sorry, that's some English mistake, is in known systems, inferred from experiments, push TC already above the scale of room temperature. I will see how graphene is a good example. I will come to it later. In fact, that will be the end of my talk. In some sense, cuprates are also failed room temperature superconductors and some another system. Now, this is something important. We discovered superconductivity in cuprate. And if you look at the family of cuprates at so-called optimal doping, there is something remarkable phenomenology. There are some cuprates where the TC is 5 Kelvin. There are some cuprates where the TC is 163 degree Kelvin. And then if you go above transition temperature, you cannot distinguish the two cuprates in terms of its normal state property. So there is some other factor which is governing the huge variation of TC from 10 Kelvin to 163 degree Kelvin. So I analyzed this. Recently, a lot of other works have taken place. What is happening is in this Mott insulator-based system, it's like Indian democracy. Many things are encouraged. So there is a lot of competition. Not necessarily, you know, what we want wins always. So there are so-called competing orders. The Hamiltonian that I wrote down, namely Howard Hamiltonian, my view is large, has several susceptibility. They have very high susceptibility for several symmetry breaking. One of them is superconductivity. There are high susceptibility for charge order. There is high susceptibility for spin order. There is high susceptibility for chiral spin order, and so on. So what happens is, depending on other interactions which you have not included in our model, namely electron-phonon interaction, electron-impurity interaction, some other orders may be favored at the expense of superconductivity. So that explains a very large variation of superconducting TC between 10 and 163 Kelvin. So if you push this a little further, there is still hope for room temperature superconductivity in cuprate, because according to some estimate, the maximum TC is about 250 Kelvin. Provided you remove the tendency for other competing orders. But that's a very, very hard thing, because that's where material scientists come into play. Because as a theorist, I may say that remove this susceptibility, but nature may not like to form such a material. So it's a big problem. So difficulties with respect to this kind of theory based on RVB is that if you go to one dimension where there are beautiful systems where the parameters should give you room temperature superconductivity, but fluctuations and competing orders like piles and spin piles very quickly kill this. I have few examples where this should have happened, but there is competing order. Similarly, in two dimensions, there are competing orders like valence. For example, this is a strange, very important competitor. I told you that if you take lanthanum copper oxide, if you take two neighboring spins, they have antiferromagnetic coupling, they would be happy to form a singlet. Now, once you form a singlet, that's like a chemical bond. The chemical bond strength will increase if two atoms come close by. So there is a coupling between this bonding and the underlying lattice. So in fact, there will be a lattice discharge. So electron-lattice coupling will increase energy of the system, or will you gain energy by forming singlets and preventing them from moving around. Because what is important in forming superconducting state is the singlets should not stay put. They should move around. They should delocalize into zero momentum state, which is superconducting. So this is a major problem. And there are other things. Okay. Now, I will not go into this. So we want to create a non-fermi liquid metallic state where real space pairing is single or singlet formation is increased. However, there are competing orders. Is there a clue from nature for another system where you don't have this competition? In fact, there is a clue. Let me check the time. How much time do we have, John? So I will finish in about 5-10 minutes. Okay, thank you. Is there a clue from nature? The answer is yes. In fact, we got this clue many years ago, so there is a small story. I was at Aspen in 1987 after getting involved in 88. I was fascinated by the romantic atmosphere at Aspen Physics Center. It's a beautiful place, flowers, views, music. So I wrote a postcard, which I will explain. And Anderson liked the postcard, so he put it at the end of one of his articles, which appeared in 1988. He says, RVBs became a question, and this is the answer. As far as we know, certainly there are bees, but maybe there are some other bees hanging around in a lot of other places. So this is the picture. See, Aspen is a beautiful place. You discuss, you sit in the garden, look at the flowers. Now, flowers bring poems, that's what they say, you know, the sight of flowers and beauty. But for a theoretical physicist like me, I start thinking about atomic orbitals. So if you look at this flower, it looks like dx square minus y square orbital. Some of you may have seen orbitals in the just behind this room a few months ago. And then this looked to me like a p orbital. And then, so I wrote to Anderson saying, are we bees? That is, I have, you, as you hear my accent, I have a strong Indian accent. So RVB, I read it as RVBs. So what do bees do? They collect honey. Now, if you generalize from this flower, there are many other kinds of flowers. For example, I can have a big flower, and I can have a flower with a lot of petals, and then other flower. But one flower I liked was this. This is a flower with four petals. This represents tetrahedral bonding that's possible in diamond and silicon and so on. So I, in my picture, hypothesized that if you replace silicon by phosphorus, you will form an impurity band, which could become a potential Morton insulator and superconductor. And in fact, it was confirmed very recently, not in silicon, but in diamond, because it's isoelectronic, the same column. I will not go into the detail. But to me, during this time, I learned a lot about Pauling's resonating valence bond state theory. Beautiful idea, which actually Anderson used in 1973 to explain a lot of phenomena in Morton insulator. So it was very clear that for these bees, the home is graphite, honeycomb lattice. So since then, I have been thinking about possible use of, you know, RVB ideas in graphite in the context of superconductivity. You remember, what Pauling said was that if you take mini graphite, namely benzene, there are six carbon atoms. After all bonding, you are left with one p-z orbital in each carbon atom. So there are six electrons and six orbital. Normally, you will form some molecular orbital and fill up the state. But Pauling said that's not a good description. A natural, important description is the one in which two electrons form a singlet like this. They form singlet bonds or a chemical bond, and the ground state is a coherent superposition of this. Now, this has profound consequences for various excited state properties of benzene. I will not go into the detail. And the same, Pauling also said this for graphene, which is an extended benzene. That is, you keep extending it. What you have is, you have basically one carbon atom and one pz orbital, two pz orbital, one electron. So what Pauling vehemently argued and made estimates of various physical properties is that, that this wave function in which these singlets resonate, so it's a many-body state in which there is resonance of, like this very simple resonance here. You have resonance among many configurations, and he called it as a resonant equivalence bond. He said that this is what leads to cohesion and important low-energy electronic properties of graphite. Now, you, when I saw this in the back in 87-88, to me, graphite has very strong this covalent or singlet tendency. Why is it never a superconductor? So I looked at the literature. Graphite does become superconducting on intercalation, but the TC was low. So it was always in the mind why the TC of graphite when intercalated is so low. Now, meanwhile, graphene became very popular, and of course, even earlier, people have done electronic structure calculations for graphene based on a very simple model called tight bending model, and many things can be explained. So on the one hand, many physicists explain properties of graphene using a free electron model. On the other hand, Pauling took an approach in which they are not free electrons, because if you notice this, even though there is fluctuations among various configurations, there is no charge fluctuation. That is, you notice that no free charge is moving around, because electrons are tightly bound and they move together, and the background neutrality is always maintained. So local charge doesn't fluctuate. Average number of electrons, that is, number of electrons per site is strictly remaining as one. So in fact, what Pauling was doing even at that time was a Mott insulator, back in the 30s, before Mott insulator was discovered. So in some sense, people would say he had a wrong wave function, because it did not describe the low-energy semi-metallic property of graphite correctly. But however, it had the right correlations, and it lived in the right corner of Hilbert space. That will be helpful later. So this is called resonating valence bond wave function. OK, now the band structure of graphene, I will not go into the detail. Now, in 2002, when I was trying to explain superconductivity in a graphene-like material, I invoked band theory plus resonating valence bond state and said that the truth is in between. And then what I found was something very interesting, that that if you take graphite and do doping, you will get a superconducting dome like this. But if I put the parameters in my phenomenological Hamiltonian, the TC was embarrassingly high, like 1,000 Kelvin. So I didn't. So I thought there is some problem. I stopped it at that paper. Then my good friend Seb Donia took the model that I introduced. In fact, he refers to my work, and then elaborated his student Anna Black Schieffer. She did detailed analysis, and Seb was not shy to put this graph, where the TC is 3,000 degree Kelvin. You don't even see 3 degree Kelvin superconducting. So why? What is going on? And in addition, they found a very remarkable state in which the superconducting order parameter is not having S symmetry. It has so-called D plus ID symmetry. Let me explain what it is. Now, if you take a graphite, graphene honeycomb lattice, imagine an electron here and another electron here forming a singlet band. And if you give the phase to this wave function, because the order parameter is a complex number, the phase is 0 here, 2 pi by 3 and 4 pi by 3. Now, it's as if your singlet is running around with angular momentum plus and angular momentum minus 1, plus 1 and minus 1. So it is a state in which time reversal symmetry is broken. In other words, the Cooper pair is a spin singlet, but angular momentum d, so d plus id. So S is a symmetric state, d is also a symmetric state, p is an odd state, and a reverse parity. So in order to preserve overall antisymmetry, if you have a spin singlet, you can have S state or D state. And this is another combination with D plus I. So this was discovered by Seb Donia. So what we decided was, let us go into a more realistic repulsive Hobart model rather than the model I started in 2002. And then there is a whole interesting history. I will not go into the details. What we found, let me describe the final result. I'm sorry about it. So what we did with state-of-the-art variational Monte Carlo calculation with Pathak and Shenoy, we took a variational approach, as we do it in strongly correlated system, and looked at possibility of superconductivity in graphene using a more conservative repulsive Hubbard model. What we found was, as a function of doping, you had this desired property, which agreed with mean field theory. But however, the TC that you can infer from various analysis is fortunately brought down from 3,000 to possibly maybe 200 or 300. So it's a very interesting result. If you use the same analysis for cuprate, you get TC in the right ballpark, namely 100 degree Kelvin or 50 degree Kelvin, depending on the parameter. So that means, according to the theory, superconductivity is possible. Then why have not people seen superconductivity in graphene so far? Now, so the idea is that you have to move away from half-filling. You cannot do things with neutral graphene, because neutral graphene, even though it has singlet correlation that Pauling suggested, the density of states vanishes at the Fermi level. So it's not able to take advantage of that and create superconducting state. So you have to move away from the zero density of state state, which is why doping is needed. Now, if you look at the doping, that is what you need, is very high. The number of carbon atoms per centimeter square is 2 × 10⁻¹⁵. So you need to get a doping of 5 × 10⁻³¹⁴. The currently available doping is 10⁻³¹. So it's very difficult to add or remove electron to the extent that we want. So this is a bottleneck. And in fact, there are some stray signals in terms of transport properties of superconductivity at this doping, like 1 or 2% doping, TC above 40 Kelvin, which is very nice. So I will not go into the details. So there are very interesting ways to dope it. But I like this way, which is the following. Now, this is some work I did recently. The idea is the following. Graphene, as I said, is not becoming a superconductor in spite of Pauling singlet correlation, because the Fermi energy lies here. So the density of states vanishes. So I have to move away to some region here in order to get good superconductor. So I dope the system. But there is another way, which is what was suggested by this Rodio Hoffman Nobel laureate from Cornell many years ago, that it is possible to have metastable structures of graphene in which you have local three-fold coordination. So the sigma and pi bonds are nearly intact, but you have five-fold and five-membered and seven-member rings. So if you do band structure for this, what you find is remarkably that at the Fermi level, the Fermi, the density of states does not vanish. So if you look at this system and analyze the same way that we did before, include Pauling's correlations, what you find is the TC can be as large as 100 Kelvin. Now, indeed, if you look at some experiments in STM and so on, there are local patches of graphene which look like this. In fact, a pair of pentagon and heptagon is called stone whales defect. This is one of the possible topological defects in a hexagonal structure. And this is found in graphene. When the defects become dense, you get this structure. So this is a very nice possibility in which you could have room temperature superconductivity. Now, as I said, in fact, I did not say that, if you look at the theory behind this Hubbard model with repulsion at intermediate coupling and large coupling, quantitative progress is extremely hard. That's why we did this variational Monte Carlo. It's difficult for us to increase the size of the system because there are many, many reasonable questions. Now, Zhaogang Wen and collaborators, and Levitov and collaborators have gone further in this analysis, and they have actually confirmed D plus ID superconductivity that we suggested is there. And so it has been shown convincingly that this tendency is there, but what is actual TC is a very hard question. Now let us go to experiments and see, in graphene or graphite-related system, has there been any signal for superconductivity? And if you look at the literature, this is a very nice reference where he summarizes all UFOs, unidentified flying object. That is, there is a Nature paper in 1970 where a Josephson-like phenomena has been seen in some carbon mess. Now, Kopelevich and Eskenazi, Pablo Eskenazi, they have been working very hard in carbon-based system, graphite and other systems. And they have seen, for example, superconductivity, 35 Kelvin in graphene sulfur composite. This is very large. And they have seen ferromagnetism. Now, many of these things are unfortunately unstable. They happen. Sometimes they do not happen. So other labs do find it occasionally. So it's not a stable thing. So people agree that something is going on. But people will agree, and the Nobel Prize will be given if a stable superconducting state at room temperature is formed. Now, there is a hot news. This, you know, after I gave this title, and then I came across this paper, the title for this colloquium. So otherwise, I would have given the title Warm Wet Superconducting. This is a very interesting work by Pablo Eskenazi. It's a very honest paper. He doesn't claim that he's seeing, he's putting experimental results in, done careful experiments in many, many possible ways. So what he does is, he takes graphite and then powders it and puts it in water. So it floats because it's hydrophobic. But if you wait for 1 hour, it sinks. And then it forms some globules. Then he heats it up and dries it and then measures magnetization as a function of magnetic field. And what he finds is very interesting. Hysteresis signal, which is what you see if you have a granular superconductor. You take a conventional superconductor and make granules out of them and mix it with some in some matrix, and then find hysteresis. This is what you see. So what you see is, taking care of many, many factors, you see hysteresis suggesting existence of granular superconductivity at 5 Kelvin as well as 300 Kelvin. So he is open to criticism. He says, this is what I see. Then this is a another problem. A rough estimate of the relative superconducting mass in a sample gives 100 parts per million. That is 1 in 10,000. Taking the diamagnetic slope at low fields without any demagnetization factor. Although small, the superconducting yield is of relevance. And interestingly, of the same order as the ferromagnetic one triggered in graphite chemical method. It's also interesting because what we have learned in the recent past is magnetism and superconductivity is based on electron correlation effect. Ferromagnetism is based often on electron-electron interaction and Kuhn's rule physics, and superconductivity is based on electron-electron interaction and super exchange physics. So they come from Pauli principle and electron-electron interaction. So he notes that they have seen signals for ferromagnetism at high temperature, again, of the same fraction. So it's now, I believe that one should give credence to some of these experiments, because people, whenever I talk to my colleagues, he says, I don't want to dirty my hand, literally, with carbon, because he wants to do a white collar job. But we should not be complacent. I think there is a message here, because according to theory, as I said, because of the two-dimensionality of graphene, and because of correlation physics there, and because the way that Pauling's correlations works in related graphitic system, one should give some importance to this. So I have been going around and telling experimental colleagues, please go back to graphene and carbon, and they don't want to touch it. Because you know something 100 parts per billion, to isolate it out and make bulk is very hard. So it's a very difficult job. But I think it's worth trying. So let me conclude by saying, okay, so this is the hot news. I hope I have given you some idea about the search for warm superconductor. It's not an easy job because our theory, the theory that we have developed so far, is not powerful enough to make quantum quantitative predictions. Condensed matter systems are extremely complex. So we have to, one useful approach is take some models and use infer the parameters of the model from experiments and then make some progress and so on. This has been an extremely useful approach in condensed matter physics, and ab initio is far from possible. In fact, I also want, today I, while searching for something about the structure of Mercury, I realized that in spite of all the advances that we have made, we cannot explain why Mercury has a melting point of 233 degrees Kelvin quantitatively. We cannot also explain using ab initio calculations like Hartree-Fock density functional theory that why it has a rhombohedral structure. And also it's interesting that Mercury is what it is because of a spin orbit coupling, relativistic effect. So in fact, this is something that people have not used, including BCS theory when they try to explain Mercury. They ignored spin orbit coupling, which is very, very important in Mercury. So maybe there is some rich physics that connection. So it's a very, very fascinating direction. If it is proved true, it will have definitely profound consequences, not only from basic science point of view, because we have learned a lot of things about entanglement. I have some ideas about hierarchy of entanglements in this new superconductor as opposed to old superconductor. I had no time to go into it. And this, how emergent gauge fields can play some role and so on. Now, when you want to see truth in our country, people go to Himalayas. It's a cold place to seek truth. So what I did was, I went to Sahara Desert. So I made a visit to Tunisia. One of my former students invited me. In fact, I gave a lecture on room temperature superconductivity. So when I went to Sahara, I was fascinated by it. So I'm sitting on a warm sand and meditating on superconductivity. I hope that this meditation had led to something. Now, this is a paper that I have written. It's an Indian journal of physics, published by Indian Academy of Sciences as part of their 125th or 75th anniversary. They brought out a special issue, which is also published here, and it's available freely. So there I defined what is called a five-fold weight superconductor. As a theorist, I'm not powerful enough to solve Hubbard model, but I can solve real problems using experiments. Now if you look around and look at what has happened in the recent last 20 years, copper has given us a route, namely doped Martin insulator. And then this is something I did not explain. You take organic superconductors, which are organic Martin insulator, squeeze them, they become superconducting. And they give you a clue to make new material that I call a pressure rule. Then diamond, it's a fascinating thing. You take beautiful diamond, glittering, whatever property it has, and replace 3% or 2% of carbon by boron. It becomes dark and dull, but it becomes superconducting. Maximum TC is 10 Kelvin. Now, if you look at the parameters, the carrier density is very low. It's a very bad metal. So you cannot explain superconductivity in the boron-doped diamond by conventional means. According to me, according to my theory, strong correlation and the kind of physics that resonating valence bond invokes is playing an important role. So that is definitely another role. That is, we have plenty of insulators in nature, not only diamond. We take a piece of sand, SiO2, is a good insulator. But unfortunately, it's very difficult to dope it. So if you can dope and create impurity band Martin insulator, there is room for high temperature superconductivity. Graphene route to something that I already. So this is fascinating. 3-4 years ago, superconductivity was discovered in an iron compound, namely iron arsenide. The TC has nearly gone up to 70. That I call as double RBB or doped spin one Martin insulator. So the route for superconductivity seemed to be based on electron-electron interaction. Phonon interactions did show us the window to superconductivity through superconductivity in mercury, but in real superconductivity, if you want, I think this seems to be more interaction. And also it's ironical. Before BCS explained superconductivity theory, Heisenberg spent a lot of time trying to explain superconductivity. And according to Heisenberg, it's Coulomb interaction which will lead to superconductivity, but he could not prove it. So did Salam. Salam also has a paper where he invoked hydrogen Coulomb repulsion, try to explain superconductivity. But what they missed was, in their work, the notion of restricted Hilbert space that a tight binding situation gives. That is, you have a finite number of single particle states. And then you have this Coulomb repulsion within the single particle state, which leads to what is called a projected Hilbert space, where many, many fascinating things happen. But they were right in the sense the Coulomb interaction could play a role. So I hope I have given you some idea that warm superconductors are probably close by. Thank you very much. Okay, so this is an important point. There is a carbon-based compound, C60 molecule. When you put them together, it forms an FCC lattice. Then you can put potassium inside, it becomes superconducting. So there are two families of theories which invoke a narrow band and electron correlation. And there are theories, I think, in NASA is also involved, in which the degeneracy of the orbitals and possible Jahn-Teller effect plays an important role. But what is fascinating is you take this system, expand it, which you can do by inserting ammonia molecule, it becomes a spin-half Martens rate. Now, the scale of TC is very similar to superconducting TC. Now, you take this system, apply again, pressure again, it becomes superconducting. So it shows that an interaction which is responsible for quantum antiferromagnetism is also playing an important role in superconductivity. So I don't think the Jahn-Teller distortion is playing a fundamental role, unlike your society. You know, there are two groups. Yeah. But it's a fascinating system. And now, experimentally, it's becoming clear it's close to a Martens rate. How the doping happens, is it through self-doping or something else? And what is the role played by Jahn-Teller effect? Still an open question.